10 million hungry teens, give or take, have options that leave them with impossible choices. And so today we pause to ask, who will help our hungry teens out of danger?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1073rd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Drummondville, up there in Drummondville, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, Jason, two questions.
Yes.
Question one, have you ever been hungry?
Yes.
Have you ever been, question two, have you ever been hungry without the prospect of food?
Unfortunately, yes.
You have?
Yes, I have, and it is not a pleasant place to be.
Well, okay. Folks, it was a perfect storm of bad news about food and our young. First was a BBC video entitled The Lost Streets of Chicago. Search and watch, but only if you want to learn about the hopelessness of being young with a gun on the streets of Chicago. Second was a Chicago Tribune article entitled Why Food Stamp Fraud is Fairly Rampant at Corner Stores in Some Chicago Neighborhoods. Search and read, but only if you want to learn how 174 corner grocers were booted out of the federal food stamp program, leaving 174 neighborhoods without a neighborhood grocer. Third was a research report from the Urban Institute entitled Impossible Choices, Teens and Food Insecurity in America. And it details how millions of Americans young live with limited options that leave them with impossible choices. There is more bad news, of course. Just yesterday, for example, there was another in the Wall Street Journal's ongoing series, The Great Unraveling. And this piece was called Social Erosion Fuels Unease. Wow. So today we get the message, and today we'll try to come to grips by looking to answer the question, who will help our hungry teens out of danger? We are working with Elaine Waxman, who's a senior fellow with the Urban Institute. Elaine, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. First of all, of course, I've always wanted to ask somebody the following question, and now I get to ask a woman. What is a senior fellow, and how did a woman become a fellow?
Yes, I think that's an inherited term from academia many, many decades ago. But fellowette doesn't really have a ring to it either.
No, it doesn't.
We stick with that.
But it does mean that you are a senior advisor or principal in the Urban Institute, correct?
It is. It's a senior researcher
The
Institute.
Mm-hmm. Good. And then the Urban Institute, what exactly is the Urban Institute?
Sure. The Urban Institute is a nonpartisan research organization and think tank based in Washington, D.C. We were actually started in the 60s as an organization charged with evaluating the war on poverty. So we have a long history of doing research on poverty.
The 60s was kind of when the whole thing started, wasn't it? In the Lyndon Johnson administration, the war on poverty?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So even though we've retained the name Urban Institute, in fact, we do all kinds of domestic work, rural, suburban, city.
Good to go. Well, impossible choices ran across this research paper of yours, and there was a line in it that just kind of stopped me cold, and it was how millions of Americans young live with limited options that leave them with impossible choices. And looked at the presentation, and it started with a quote from a teenage boy in Illinois. People have to do other things. They do what they have to do to survive because not everyone can go out and get a job. That's pretty sad.
Yeah, this was a very sobering project to work on. We interviewed teens through focus groups in 10 different communities around the country, including cities, smaller towns, and some semi-rural areas. And we were really struck by how widespread food insecurity is in teenage experience, and how aware they are of the larger forces that make it difficult for their families to afford food, and how they also understand that the choices that some kids may make in order to try to help out their household or feed themselves mm-hmm. are not good, but they feel there's no other option.
10 million, thereabouts, give or take, 10 million are insecure in their food, which is to say, you know, when they get hungry, there is not a prospect of food readily at hand, right?
So food insecurity is a household-level condition, meaning uncertain or unstable access to food to lead a healthy life. So for some people, that may mean, you know, stretching things, making not the healthiest choices but the cheapest choices, eating the same things every day, a very, very limited diet, which we know wouldn't be healthy. For others, though, it may mean actually skipping meals, going a whole day without food in the most significant cases. There are about 1 in 6 kids in America who live in food insecure households.
1 in 6?
Yes.
In the land of plenty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, about 42 million Americans overall of all ages who live in food insecure households.
Well, you know, when we put out the press release for this program, my wife, who does the graphics for each press release, which you can see on metrofarm.com, went looking for an image of, you know, hunger. And she thought, well, must be in the inner city. So she went, Googled, and searched her way into Chicago, into the neighborhoods where there was a lot of trouble and whatnot, expecting to find neighborhoods of, you know, tenement housing and whatnot. But what shocked her, surprised her, flabbergasted her, was that the areas of great crime and trouble were areas that were middle-class homes. And those homes were like boarded up and gone. And I guess that's what really shocked her, was that these were not, you know, necessarily neighborhoods of traditional poverty.
Yeah, I appreciate you raising that point, because I think our assumptions about what food insecurity looks like need to be reexamined. We know food insecurity is present in every single county in the United States, no matter how wealthy. All of the kids that we talked to in our study were housed. So sometimes you will, you know, hear talk of...
So we're not talking homeless people here then?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, they may live in public housing, they may live in market rental housing, they may live in homes that were owned but, you know, maybe on the brink of foreclosure. We had a very big jump in food insecurity at the beginning of the Great Recession, and it's only now beginning to abate.
Wow. That's quite a while to be insecure, food insecure then, isn't it? We're good almost 10 years.
Yes, and, you know, that's something that I think we have to remember as the economy begins to improve, is that it takes a long time for people to dig out of that kind of economic shock, and not everybody digs out at the same rate.
Right. Well, tell us about the kids. You worked, you looked principally at teenagers, correct?
Absolutely. You know, there's been a lot of research on child hunger, and mm-hmm. for all the reasons we can think of, we're very concerned about early childhood development, but not very much on teenagers.
And teenagers being not yet adults and past childhood. So they're in that nether world where they're essentially responsible but not.
Absolutely. And it's another critical development period in terms of physical change, emotional change, behaviors. This is a time when teens acquire behaviors that can, you know, carry with them throughout their adulthood and, you know, change the path of their adulthood. So it's a very pivotal point.
And they're 10 to 17, you say?
Yes, it's what we call kind of the second decade, but, you know, roughly up until 18. Obviously, there's a lot of difference in that age range, but increasingly these are kids who feel some sense of responsibility for what's going on in their household. They may be working to shield younger brothers and sisters from the challenges the family is experiencing, looking for work to try to supplement their family's household. And in some cases, you know, where work is not available, and that's pretty common these days for teenagers, you know, they may turn to more risky behaviors.
And that's where we're going to go, risky behaviors, when we get back, because we're looking at how children feed themselves when there's no secure way of feeding themselves. Happens in the city, happens in the country, it happens everywhere, in every county in the United States. And the question that we have on the table today, who will help our hungry teens out of danger? What do you think? 831-479-1080. Right back for Elaine Waxman.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land, we can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, folks, the title of the research paper was Impossible Choices, Teens and Food Insecurity in America. Urban Institute put it out. Not very fun reading at all. Very, really sad, actually, to read about how our youth are going hungry and what they have to do to feed themselves. I ran across another piece of information just yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. They're doing an ongoing series entitled The Unraveling of America, and this was one of the pieces in it. And it struck me because I'm in the Lions Club, and here's what it had to say about the Lions Club. Gustav Meyer, who oversees Lions Clubs in the Berks County, Pennsylvania area, says members try to help some single parents with food, rent, and utilities. But it's tough because the district's membership has declined 43% in the last 20 years. And I see that in my Lions Club as well, just disappearing. In fact, the article goes on to say the number of civic, professional, and business organizations in Berks and neighboring counties declined to 131 from 156 since 2000. There it is, 6 years. And it's just evaporating. So Ruth Gonzalez, 44, is getting help from the Lions Club in trying to renegotiate 2 mortgages on her house, which is facing foreclosure because she fell behind with medical bills and whatnot. So I guess that's kind of a thumbnail of exactly what you're talking about, Elaine.
Absolutely. I think there are many families who are, you know, just struggling paycheck to paycheck, and one trip to the emergency room or one auto repair bill or, you know, a drop in hours at your job can really put you into a position where you're trading off between very basic household needs. I remember a girl in our study from North Carolina who talked about how her family had adopted a strategy of taking one utility off each week of the month in order to afford food. So they would have 1 week without power, 1 week without telephone. You know, that's, people are very creative in their coping strategies, but there becomes a time when that's just not enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, limited options and impossible choices. Tough thing to be facing for anybody. One of the first things that, you know, people tend to do, from what I read in your research paper, to cope is you cut back on food.
Absolutely. I think food budgets is one of the first things to go, right? Because it's the thing that can be seen as discretionary, although we hate to think about that.
We think of food as being discretionary.
Right. Ooh. Right, which is troubling. But in fact, that's, you know, an expense that we can potentially juggle, whereas the rent is the same and the utility is the, you know, it is what it is. We, you know, heard about families who, again, survive on maybe the same things most months, maybe at the beginning of the month when they've gotten a new paycheck or they may have gotten SNAP benefits, things are better, but by late in the month, you know, things are getting pretty tough. Kids will do things like try to eat over at a friend's house to help spare their family resources, try to eat at a relative's house, save their school lunch and eat it on the weekend. So they very much feel sort of that adult responsibility to try to help buffer the household.
Well, if you think about, you know, limited choices, limited options, they're really, you know, I guess when you're down to the gritty nitty, there aren't really a lot of options, are there? I mean, you have food, you have rent. You don't want to put away the rent because then you're out on the street. You need gasoline to get back and forth to work.
Right, absolutely. So food, unfortunately, becomes some of that buffer zone. I think that a lot of families would like to eat better, and we heard that from kids, you know, about being frustrated that what they perceive is healthier foods, fresh produce and whatever feels out of reach to them. And part of that is not just the cost, but the risk of perishability. So the sense that if you don't have things in the house that can last a long time and kind of spread over everybody, it's too risky to buy. I remember a girl in San Diego, California, talking about how they almost never bought fresh produce, but that was something that they would purchase if company was coming over.
And so get very particular about what you do buy. When you talked, how did you talk with these kids? You were talking with about 10 years old to 17 years old. You know, that's a tough time of life. That's, you know, you're going through some big changes. And how did you sit these kids down and actually talk to them so that they would talk back to you?
Sure. So most of the kids in the group were closer to 12 and up.
12 and up, okay.
But the focus groups, we worked with social service providers in all of these communities to recruit kids' areas. We also used young research assistants to conduct the focus groups because, you know, I think it's more comfortable for kids if they see someone who looks similar to them in age. And then we ask very general questions about what they see going on in their communities. So we don't ask them to self-disclose about their own situation.
Oh, there you go. That's probably really clever then. If you don't ask them about what's happening to them, but what's happening to their friends, they might be more willing to talk.
Absolutely. And so we did hear about what's going on with friends and neighbors, but eventually some kids did self-disclose about things that they had experienced, including, for example, bullying and being made fun of for being the kid with, you know, who had to take school breakfast, free school breakfast, or who didn't have enough food. Even in low-income communities, kids have an intense of embarrassment of being known as the kid whose family didn't have enough to eat.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, that's the bullying, the emotional bullying is probably so intense in that age group. You just... I remember going to grade school and school myself. You know, that was a terrifying time in many respects. And if you're the person without, I remember bringing a sack lunch, you know, and having people look at me. But it was good food, but it was a sack lunch, and you weren't buying the cafeteria food and so on.
Absolutely, and that we heard that over and over again. The kids really... stigma is the number one thing. They're very concerned about being seen going to get charitable food. They don't want people to know what's going on. They said, you know, if you want to help us, make it so that people don't have to see. Because, you know, the most important thing to a teenager is looking like you're on top of your game.
Right, right. So if you want to help us, make sure people don't see.
Absolutely. So one of the things, you know, we asked is, you know, do you go to food pantries? Do you go to meal programs? And they said, well, in some cases they weren't aware where those were or if they were available. In other cases they felt that those weren't available to them, that they would have to be adults. Or conversely, that maybe things were only designed for little kids, but not for them. And then they also said, you know, I don't want to be seen standing in that line. What they did say is, you know, if you put on a free concert in a park or you have some kind of program and you happen to offer food, we're all about that. We would love to, you know, come and have activities, but we want to be seen as going to an activity where we happen to be able to eat and not seen as just showing up to get a meal.
Well, that's really interesting because so many, you know, food programs are designed around that notion of charity. That you can't feed yourself, we are going to feed you for you. That's just exactly the opposite of what we should be doing, I guess, right?
You know, I think that they appreciate that those are things that can really tide a family over, but again, from their perspective, they want that to be part of other things that they might be participating in. Mm-hmm. They don't want that to be the goal. I think the other thing we heard is that, you know, for them, in terms of a feeling of self-worth and dignity, being able to shop in a grocery store like anybody else is really important. So, for them, being able to access SNAP benefits or WIC benefits, or, you know,
with a card instead of stamps, right?
Right, right, exactly. It was really important because it made them feel like a part of, you know, the regular economy.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break. The question of the day, who will feed our hungry teens out of the danger they face with impossible choices of feeding themselves? 831-479-1080, right back. Who do you think is going to feed them? Well, folks, question on the table today. Who will feed our young, hungry teens who are facing some very limited options on what they can eat? And sometimes those limited options force them into impossible decisions. That's the question we have on the table today. We're talking with Elaine Waxman, who's a senior fellow with the Urban Institute, who put out a research paper entitled Impossible Choices, Teens and Food Insecurity in America. Elaine, we were talking about how kids are reluctant to go stand in line for charity food, but the transition from, like we said, from food stamps to the SNAP card allows them to go through the line and look like everybody else. It makes a big difference, huh?
Absolutely. They very much want to be seen as, you know, participating in the same ways that other people acquire their food and being able to have choices. And we heard that over and over again, how much they appreciated that safety net when their families needed it.
Mm-hmm. Does your research paper look at the why that there's so much food insecurity? Is simply a matter of no money?
Yes, I think, you know, again, we were looking at it from the perspective of kids. So mm-hmm. they're telling us their stories, but they can talk really eloquently about jobs that don't pay enough to meet all of the expenses of the family, the ups and downs of hours in some jobs, you know, single parent households who may not have the resources that they need to take care of mm-hmm. the family. So, you know, they have a good understanding of sort of what those sort of bigger economic issues are that are driving it. And then for them, though, it comes down, obviously, to day-to-day decisions they have.
Sure, sure. Do you have any statistics on childhood or young people's hunger and the rate of single-parent households?
So there are a number of populations for whom food insecurity rates are higher. Single-parent households are definitely more at risk, and that's both single moms and single dads.
Right.
Also, African-American communities, Hispanic or Latino communities, American Indian or Native American communities have very high rates of food insecurity. But you also see it in, for example, suburban areas where living costs may be pretty high, mm-hmm. but there may be a lot of service jobs that people are working and not able to fully make ends meet.
So you might be in a nice neighborhood, but the costs might be so high that you can't deal with them anyway.
Right, and sometimes families make very deliberate choices to maybe live in, you know, what they regard as a safer, nicer neighborhood that may cost them more. The problem is then that rent burden really eats into the family budget in terms of things that you can pay for.
And so, as you said earlier, in every county in the United States.
Absolutely. I think that's hard for people to believe, and actually if you are interested, you can go on the Feeding America website, feedingamerica.org, which is the national network of food banks, and look up your home county, and it will give you estimates of the rate of food insecurity, the number of food insecure folks in your backyard, and also a little bit about their financial resources.
Well, you know, traditionally, of course, the big feeder of people was the family. That seemed to be the way it's worked forever. And yet it seems to be changing significantly to government in a lot of respects, because government is now feeding children breakfast, lunch, and dinner at school. I noticed from some of the findings that you have in your paper that, you know, kids are actually doing things that they shouldn't do in order to be forced into schools in summertime so they can eat.
Yeah, we did hear that a bit. For example, a young man in Chicago who had talked about, deliberately flunking class so that he would have to go to summer school because he knew he would have regular meals. We heard a couple of examples of kids who talked about friends deliberately getting arrested because they knew that if they went to juvenile detention, there would be regular meals and a place they could go. Those are, pretty heart-rending stories, and obviously those are also decisions that carry consequences that kids take forward with them into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to government nutrition programs, we have a lot of them, it seems, taking care of kids at schools. We also have, a nationwide organization of food banks, as you were speaking about earlier. Now, is that where the kids feel the stigma is when they go to the food bank? Would that be different than going to school?
I think for them, they understand that can be really valuable for their families, but if they were to go themselves, they often feel embarrassed or out of place, or that maybe that's for younger kids or it's for their parents, but, it's not necessarily designed for them. They also say that actually about the summer feeding program. There is a federal program designed to provide summer meals when kids are out of school, but very few kids who get free and reduced price lunch during the year actually participate in that. There are a lot of barriers to that, but one of them is that they don't see that as being for them. They assume it's often for younger kids. It's also really hard, particularly if you live in a rural area, to get to a meal site every day. That would be money that a family might be spending on food.
Right.
For gas or bus fare.
You know, that's an interesting question. Is it better to be hungry in the city or in the suburbs or in the country?
Wow. It's not good to be hungry anywhere, right?
Right.
I think this is a really under-discussed topic in America, how much food insecurity goes on in rural areas. Rural counties actually often have higher rates of food insecurity. When we use the word, the term food desert, we often have a very specific picture in our mind of an urban community. But in fact, a lot of rural communities are some of the worst food deserts there are. It may be an hour to a grocery store. And
especially given the fact that, we have turned our countryside into commodity factories where there used to be family farms that used to grow a lot of food to feed people. Now they're commodity farms, where they're growing a million acres of soybeans, and it can get very hungry if you're in the middle of a million acres of soybeans.
Absolutely, and what's interesting is that some of the highest food insecurity rates are in top-producing agricultural counties. So, for example, in California, where you also produce a lot of fruits and vegetables. Those workers who are, you know, bringing us that food as a nation are often unable to afford a regular diet.
Hear a lot about it, that's for sure. Folks, we're talking about how our young people are feeding themselves. They have very limited options in a lot of cases. And sometimes those limited options lead to some impossible choices as to what to eat and how to feed themselves. And so when we get back from this break, I'd like to ask Elaine Waxman, who is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, just exactly what some of those impossible options are, or some impossible choices. And you, of course, are invited to participate with your comments and questions and whatnot. My question to you out there is, who will help feed our hungry teens? Who will lift them up out of the danger they face through their hunger? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, in the BBC television documentary, The Lost Streets of Chicago, we see the young with guns on the streets of Chicago, always looking over their shoulder, always wondering, always furtive. And we wonder how they go about feeding themselves in those situations in which there is very little hope for the future. And I guess that's what the Urban Institute found in their research paper, Impossible Choices. So we're down to the impossible choices. What are they, Elaine?
So we're not sure how often this happens, but we do know it happens for a subset of teens because it was raised in virtually every community that we talked to.
Every community?
And every community of the, we talked to teens in 10 different communities, and all of them raised the problems that some teens face in terms of turning to behaviors that we know are very risky. So that may range from, you know, taking an item from a grocery store when you don't have enough to eat, shoplifting to get some items that you might sell to get some cash. It can also then, you know, move over into more troublesome things like joining a gang, you know, hanging out with the wrong crowd. And then particularly for young women, there is sometimes a risk of being in sort of transactional dating relationships, if you will, dating older men who have some money in order to get a meal paid for, or maybe they can kick in on the family's rent. So there are ways in which kids, the behaviors that, you know, we see and we are concerned about, but don't sometimes think about what might be driving some of that.
Mm-hmm. And once engaged in those kinds of behaviors, it becomes increasingly ever more difficult to get out of those behaviors.
Absolutely. And we know, we remember that we're dealing with teenagers who are have impulse control issues to begin with, right? I mean,
right.
That's just part of that stage of life, and so they may make, you know, quick decisions that seem right in the moment, but can, you know, carry consequences for the long term in terms of their ability, for example, to stay in school or to get employment later on, you know, to have healthy relationships with others. So that's particularly worrisome.
Well, there's a lot here that's worrisome. You know, we, you know, see all of the reports of the, well, what the Wall Street Journal calls the unraveling of America. We see the loss of our service clubs like the Lions and the Rotary, and the loss of our churches, and you know, communities are even having trouble finding volunteer firefighters anymore. And so we look at this situation and we wonder, who will feed those kids out of danger? Elaine?
Well, I think it's a very critical and important question, and I guess my answer is it's not one particular solution. It's probably you know, a grab bag of solutions. Certainly, government programs continue to be a front line for low-income families, and the strength of those are important, particularly the SNAP program. better jobs. There's no substitute for better jobs. And also for youth employment. You know, a lot of these kids talked about, well, you know, I try to get a job, but, of course, they're competing with older youth or adults in their neighborhoods for very limited jobs. So they're not going to be first in line. You know, they might pick up a quick hustle. They might do hair or cut grass, but that's not necessarily going to be consistent. So I would say that, you know, we need to have a serious conversation about creating youth employment opportunities that are really meaningful, so that, you know, kids have an option to engage in, you know, the kinds of mainstream economy that we all want and that they want. You know, they express the same values as the rest of us.
I sometimes make the argument that the single biggest mistake of modern times was taking people off the farm and putting them into the city. And, you know, you look at the great agriculture, the productivity of our agriculture and the immense production of food that we put out. And yet there's very few people doing the work anymore. And those people who used to do the work are now hanging around on the street corner in the cities wondering what to do. And there isn't any work for them to do in the cities, is there? I mean, that seems to be the big problem. There's just nothing there for people to do if you're not one of those smart enough to be pushing digits around on a computer screen.
I mean, certainly in many communities, particularly for teenagers, there's just simply not enough work or not sustainable work. You know, there is, I think, in some areas an opportunity for urban farming. And that's, I think, something kids are really interested in. That's something that they raised with us. They, you know, a few of them had been attending schools with school gardens. They are interested in food. They're interested in where it comes from. But, you know, most of them, as you know, really aren't engaged and don't have that exposure.
Well, and it's hard to get there, too, if you're not there in the, to start with. If you have no knowledge about, the growth and productivity of crops, and where do you go? Well, that's what we're going to figure out when we come back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Elaine Waxman. She's the senior fellow from the Urban Institute. Their paper, Impossible Choices, Teens and Food Insecurity in America. And when we come back, what about the future of those teens in America? Who on earth, who's going to do the job of helping those hungry teens out of the danger that they're in? Or will anybody? That's the question. What do you think? 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, Elaine Waxman, and you. Pick up your phone. Couple minutes left and join us. Thank you. Well, it seems like what the good folks at the Urban Institute are saying in their Limited Options, Impossible Choices paper is that the hungrier you get, the more dangerous your living situation becomes. Fair summation, Elaine?
Yes, I think it is. You know, in the beginning, you know, if your family is struggling to make ends meet, it may be enough to buy the the microwavable cans for a dollar, or, save your school lunch. I think for some kids, though, it eventually veers over into coping strategies that, when we look at it on the face of it, we say, wow, you know, that's a bad kid. Well, we need to dig underneath and understand what might be driving some of that.
Well, yeah. And so what can we do about it? I mean, 10 million young teenagers, 10 to 17 years old, not yet adults and past being children, in that great transition period into self-sufficiency, and facing some very limited options that lead to some very impossible choices. What can we do to help them out?
So I think the first thing we ought to do is ask teenagers, right? We just don't do a good job of soliciting their opinions about programs and strategies that would actually help them. So, for example, you know, ask them why they don't come to summer food programs and what would work better. the USDA has been experimenting with adding some benefits in the summer for kids who have a SNAP or a WIC card so that families can buy more groceries rather than trying to figure out how to get to a meal program, which may be really far away from them. So that's a creative government idea. I think we also, in the charitable food world, need to ask teens, you know, what could we do? How could we meet your needs? What would you feel comfortable doing? And then, you know, teens themselves can be part of the solution. We're currently working with a group of teenagers in Portland, Oregon, on a demonstration project because during the focus group discussions, they said, you know, this is really sad. We want to do something about this. And so they organized a what they call a harvest share. It's a mobile produce distribution that comes to their community every month. They run it in conjunction with the Oregon Food Bank. And now they're also working on training other youth about issues of food justice and trying to think about what's their next step. So I think we underestimate kids a lot.
Well, and we always have. When we take kids, you know, out of work, and we don't let them work and we force them to stand around, we are disrespecting them. We are taking away a lot from their lives, I think. I might be wrong, but it seems like that. Is there a limitation to what government can do? I mean, 55 million of us are now on food stamps. There are a lot of people.
Yeah, it's actually started to come down recently, so I think it's getting closer to the low 40 millions, but that's still a lot. I think there's two things. One, you know, sometimes SNAP is a supplement to people's work, and there, you know, we have to realize that that's part of our low-wage job economy. It's not that people aren't working. But, yeah, ultimately we need to do something about making sure that people have work that can support their families.
Amen to that.
Absolutely, right?
Elaine, want to thank you so much. Elaine Waxman, Senior Fellow, Urban Institute. Thank you all for tuning in out there. You got to remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in that food. Elaine Waxman, thank you so much for joining us from the Urban Institute. And thank you all for tuning in Food Chain Radio.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.